Hey, everybody. This is John. Excuse my voice. I'm a little bit sick right now. We're going to get into a really exciting interview with Sari Huri of Filakaria Winery in Bethlehem. But before we do, I thought you would, it would be, you know, I'd be remiss to not mention that by the time you're hearing this, you will have a little bit over a week and a half to sign up for the Disgorgeous Wine Club at copaicwineworks.com/disgorgeous. Three bottles of wine for $150 delivered to your door. It is themed off of our Austro-Hungarian season. I'm really excited about the wines. We have limited spaces available, and I think we're going to sell out. But if you're listening to this and that kind of gives you a little bit of a fire under your ass, then you should do it. It's going to be really, 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 really fun. I'm super excited, and it's going to be a canonical episode of the podcast that only you'll get to listen to. So again, that's copaicwineworks.com/disgorgeous. And the deadline for that, I believe, is February 29th, but you should do it before then because I think it will sell out. Second, if you like this interview and you want to hear more interviews, patreon.com/regular/disgorgeous is where the Crush Pad series of interviews lives. It is me interviewing winemakers from all around the world, actually. It's pretty exciting. It's like $5 a month to join. And it's a smart, they're all smart episodes, unlike the main feed of Disgorgeous, which are dumb and stupid. So think about that. For the record, if you have money to do either of those things, then you should also probably donate to the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund, or find out how to donate a SIM card to Palestinian refugees, or at the very least, write or call your senators or congresspeople, or send an angry DM to Joe Biden, if nothing else, or show up at a march or a protest. What's being done in Palestine right now is some of the most barbaric shit that's... I mean, it's all been pretty barbaric the last 8,000 years, but it's fucking vile. And it is being done in, if you are an American listening to this, in your name and with your tax dollars. And I think that we probably can't fix things, but we do have a responsibility to do what we can to help. So again, join the Patreon, join the wine club. But before you do those, see if you can just lend a helping hand anywhere. Sorry to sound so preachy. I love you all. And this has been a very, very, very dark period for Disgorgeous and for the world at large. And, you know, the only way we get through it is by being together. All right. Now, without further ado, here is an interview that is actually not a bummer and is really beautiful.
Disgorgeous.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Disgorgeous. This is what we call a very special episode. I'm here with Sari Huri I just forgot how to pronounce Greek. Filakaria?
Filakaria.
Filakaria. In Bethlehem. I am so excited. Been a big fan. Obviously not enough of a fan to learn how to pronounce the name of the winery, but it, you know, I think the wine's good. Maybe next vintage I'll remember how to say it. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you invite me for such an occasion. And in these circumstances, it's even nice to be connecting with people across the world. We haven't been able to move much geographically even.
Hopefully, I would love to say that these quote unquote circumstances won't be long lasting. So maybe just for the people who listen to this in 2 weeks, when I'm sure this will all be over, let's talk about what kind of circumstances we're dealing with right now. To put a date, this is February 5th, 2024, and it's been about 100 days since October 7th. Is that correct?
Almost 120, yes.
Jesus fucking Christ. Can we talk, can you, before we start, can we talk a little bit about how things have changed since then for you, if that's okay?
Yes, of course. Every vintage, when we start to work, we don't really plan things. We just keep working, so to speak, trying to do the best we can. But this was the first year in about 10 years of winemaking now. I think it was my ninth vintage, where somehow I had set the date of October 6th to be the day this season would finish.
Okay, cool.
All right. And everyone was like, why do you set a date so early? I said, I don't care. The 7th of October is my father's birthday, and he's been in quite a bad health condition. So I said I'm going to spend this day with him, because I'm between this wine thing and my other work, which is I'm an architect by profession. So I had set the day of October 6th.
Fortuitously.
Anyways, yes. And then, on the last minute, I was saying maybe it takes a few more days, but then we still insist on October 6th. And since October 7th, we haven't been able to go back to the vineyard and work.
Oh, my.
So we've been banned from the vineyard because of our proximity to settlements. I snuck in one time where I was not disturbed by the army because I had to tie some vines that had fallen from the wind. But since then, we've been banned from work. And every time we do try to work, the army comes in and kicks us out. So we don't know where we're going with things. You know, we depend on non-irrigated vines because we have no access to irrigation water.
Okay.
And anyway, the quality of the crop is better that way. But we still don't have water when we need it. So it's very important that we depend on tillage, which opens up the soil to bring in water during the rainy season, which is now. But we haven't been able to do any vineyard preparations for the winter.
Severe is the winter generally? Like, do you get, you don't hit freezing often, right? The grapes are going to not die, perhaps?
Well, in this case, what we need is we get the ideal about maybe 450 to 550 mil of rain a year. And we need this period of the year for the soil to absorb the water. And the tillage is a way to break up the soil so that the water comes in. We have a good flux, you know, in this area, Bethlehem itself here, I'm about maybe 750, almost 800 meters above sea level. The vineyards are at 930, depending on the plot, between 910 and 940 meters above sea level. So there's a good flux of temperature between day and night anyway. And it gets rather chilly. Some years we get a few days of snow. Maybe almost all years we get one or two days of snow minimum.
I mean, that's more than we get here in New York. We're subtropical now, baby. It sucks. It's a fucking swamp.
I know, surrounded by all those buildings, it's not exactly the same.
No, it's not particularly romantic, but what can you do? I lived in Istanbul in 2012, and I remember there was a snowstorm that that just covered Istanbul. I remember seeing photos of Jerusalem covered in snow that day as well. So not that I'm good at geography or remembering things, but I'm always like, it can snow there. How beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have many microclimates in such a small geographic area. It's pretty small. It's like a kind of microcosm.
Yeah. There's a lot of different things going on is a way of describing where you are. I would like to, so you mentioned the proximity to settlements. Can we talk a little bit about, I guess, how that complicates things? And I promise we're gonna have some positive fun chat soon. But I feel like it's good to get this out of the way. You guys are in the occupied West Bank. Are you the settlements? Are they encroaching in the vineyard lands?
The settlement project is an encroachment project overall. So over the last 10 years, I've been in this one area. They have been expanding in a sort of crescent form around us.
Okay.
I don't know where it's going. It's hard to say.
Yeah, probably nowhere awesome.
I don't think so either. But it's this is a strategic project, you understand. It's not a random one-off sort of person saying, oh, let's take some land just because I have some power. This is a very strategic, long-term, well-planned, well-funded project that finally the particularities of a certain plot of land or something, you know, it's a subject to certain specifics. So when and where and why and whom, these are details. But there is a general project of expansionist, the colonialist mechanism, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And so it will affect eventually every area if it keeps going this way, of course. So we don't know when and how, but yes, obviously asking expansion, even in the expansion into winemaking in the area, because
I've been seeing some articles, Wine Spectator, really going very hard for wineries in the Golan Heights for some fucking reason. I'd love to hear more about this, but yeah, wine seems to be a nexus of expansion for the settler movement in a weird way.
Of course, and then also, you know, they're starting a system. I don't know the term in English, forgive me, but like the equivalent of the French AOC, right? Appellation d'origine contrôlée.
I think in English we just say AOC. Like,
okay. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure there's a better term for it, appellation system.
Yes, appellation system. That's that. So they've started this one called the Judean Hills, which apparently includes my vineyards.
Oh, okay, cool.
And it goes all the way halfway from here between here and the coast, which is not huge, right? So it's let's say an hour drive westwards, but just it's a completely different world, and it's done by design, political design. It has a historic symbolism that's meant to create a sense of rootedness, but then the outline is completely political. And I laugh at that because it's hard to convince, you know, I work with a lot of old farmers that have this tremendous sensibility to the place and the soil and the plants and the climate and the tradition. And then we have this expression in Arabic that essentially means the land variations. Now, to say that an appellation system wouldn't even work for an Arab so well, because they say the land variations are what's called shibir. Shibir is the distance between your pinky and your thumb, right? So as you're moving along the soil in this type of like a foot long, right, distance, there are variations in the soil and you know the eventual impact, of course, on the group. So you have someone just drawing a big line like Lord Balfour, maybe. You
know, yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah,
let's take a big territory. And here's a farmer that's saying, there's a variation every 30 centimeters. I don't know how they can have a practical discussion.
Well, I mean, it's, I'm going to say this is interesting because, of course, AOCs are always insanely political. This one, like most things, when you start talking about Israel and Palestine, it's most subtexts become incredibly very textually active when you like, all the stuff that we're just kind of whispering about, especially in wine, becomes like, oh yes, this AOC requires violence to be done is a surprising twist that I don't think the guys in the Jura, when they wanted to have their wines protected, would have prophesied. But of course, I guess anytime Europeans draw lines anywhere, someone's getting killed. But it truly, may we live in interesting times is probably not the nicest thing to say to anyone. But you guys are getting to see a lot of exciting things happening.
It is interesting on a day-to-day basis. It's you go home with a lot of questions, that's for sure.
Something that I, when I spoke with Jason from Terra Sancta, he mentioned that there was some of his growers have been in the position of having to buy grapes from the settlers. Is this a thing that you've encountered? Is this a thing that, is this a new reality that's happening in your region or not yet?
I think in his case, he's referring specifically to one winery where their personal family property was actually the land that has been settled, right? And that's in the Galilee, in the northern Galilee, the Ashbar family and Ashbar winery. So in that area, the Palestinian grape heritage, grapevine heritage, has been exterminated completely. You know, when the same thing that happened when there was sort of trade between the US and Europe and Phylloxera came to Europe. So the European Zionists who brought grapevines from Europe here also brought Phylloxera with them, and it basically massacred the majority of our vineyards. Our landscape was typically, so if you saw a picture of a typical landscape in the area, you would probably see just a lot of olive trees. But historically, it was like one olive tree, one vine, one olive tree, one vine, in the same plot. So they've lost their vines, and in the Galilee more, our area still has grapes from the original native grapes.
Are they, they're all own-rooted still?
Excuse me?
They're on their own root stock currently?
There's a combination. I mean, you know, we have some vines that are, well, some vines are 130 years old, a few of them, but there's a good number. There's a good number that's in the 90 plus. I have some 60 and some 70. And we have some, you know, 10-year-old and 15-year-old. The more recent ones have been grafted. I don't understand why in some vineyards, honestly, that you would plant a young vine that's non-grafted and it would die. But you would plant, you would keep some old vines really survive. And the farmers, they had this method that really they would essentially plant a whole branch very deep into the soil, almost a meter deep. The one interpretation is that at that depth, somehow the Phylloxera bug doesn't go that deep. I don't have a scientific explanation. But in the case of the Ashbar family, they had to buy grapes from, I don't know if they had to, but they ended up buying grapes from someone who had settled their family land in the Galilee. And since they work with the same grapes that the Israelis plant, which are, you know, the Cabernets and, and the typical varietals from the world. No, in my case, I'm not in that same situation. And I don't know if I'll have to and sort of call my wines from the Judean hills one day. But if I had to plant Cabernets, I know I would definitely shut down this project.
There's a quote that I just read from you that I would love to just read into the record, which is the idea of making a Palestinian wine with grape varietals such as Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot is akin to chopping off the feet before one begins to walk. Yes. I think so cool. I love that. Can you, and I think this is actually, we're going to be talking about the ideas of indigeneity and rootedness, I think, for this entire interview. So I think this is probably a good jumping off spot. Why do you feel that way about Cabernet and Merlot, in your region? And then, maybe we should talk a little bit about what grapes you do like and why you like them. Is that a broad enough question for you? Do you want me to get even less specific?
No, it's fantastic. I have nothing against the Cabernets and the Merlot. This has nothing to do with the Cabernet. It's more to do with what the Palestinian has to do.
Of course. Right? So
there's no issue with Cabernets.
No, we say, you know, no one hates Chardonnay. You hate capitalism, and like, and it's you don't hate Merlot. You hate imperialism. We're good, man.
And if you hate Cabernet Franc, just try a Cheval Blanc, and then maybe we can have a discussion one more.
Okay, guilty. Yeah.
I tell you, for several reasons. I take a craftsman's approach to my work. And if I come to you or anyone with a good example of a Cabernet that's made locally, but value for money and quality relevance, if it's at the same quality of another wine from somewhere in France or maybe South America, and it's four times more expensive, how much confidence do I have to come, you know, present this product to you? Mm-hmm. Our production is local, but our competition is global. And I believe that if I wanted to come to anybody with something, I should know first why it's worth anything, right? So, and I know that I can't offer anything of value, especially value for money, for any of these grapes, you know, Cabernets and the more standardized common international varietals. So in this context, it's very hard to offer value for money out of it, in which case I'm not at a good starting point. The second thing is to plant them in this climate, you depend on irrigation, and that means that the quality is already reduced.
Of course.
Right? The third thing is having to do with knowing who you are. So I understand if you're in Australia and you wanted to produce wine and you start off with what examples you've had in your country for the last, let's say, 200 years. But when you have 10,000 years of grape planting and farming history, right? 6,000 years of export, wine export history, and you ignore it and you pay attention to what came to you in recent history from another part of the world, and you say, that's it, I found the answer. You don't even know what it means to be Palestinian, let alone to be a good winemaker in today's economic, you know, and global context. Right. And then I think that, you know, like if there's an attempt to make any serious, to establish the foundations of a serious wine producing culture, somehow with exceptions, of course, the US being one of them, but that's for different cultural reasons. But in the, let's say in the old world, there was always a relationship between local wine, local cuisine, and local climate. So you're trying to make wines that have some relevance, right? As a starting point, maybe you develop it and you refine it and you do different things with it some generations down the line. But there has to be some starting point, some foundational philosophy. And you can say the Italians make their local wines and they're fantastic, and the French do and the Portuguese do. But at some point in history, there was that link between those three fundamental elements. And that pushes you automatically to native grapes. On one level. The other level is a little bit personal, maybe, but I think it's more and more relevant for everyone, which is the element of exploration. So you've never made a Cabernet maybe in your life, but if you were to Google how to ferment Cabernet Sauvignon, you would have thousands of different suggestions based on what kind of wine.
There's a couple,
Right? There's a lot of information, but I enjoy the creative exploration aspect, the dealing with the unknown, of digging in this heritage, trying to find things and trying to discover some new flavor. Because what is the ceiling of discovery for me as an individual today if I were to try to make a Cabernet Sauvignon? The most is I will make a decent, maybe very good, maybe excellent Cabernet Sauvignon, and end of story. There is no personal growth in the experience. There is no discovery. And that's not interesting for the human spirit, you know. Besides saying I want to be a winemaker, it's about my existence with my activity, myself, every day. Do I want to expand and grow and discover, or do I just want a title and a job and income and a lifestyle? It's a question you ask yourself. I can't force that question on other Palestinian or Israeli winemakers, you know. But I know what my need is, and this project is designed around personal values, personal questions. It's not even about wine, but in the process, you could still make, you know, a very good wine, a unique wine, a certain special offering of something different from what there is in the world, or has a different expression. And you can grow and you can explore. You can do, you can have a holistic approach.
I feel like it is worth mentioning that the vast majority of explicitly Israeli wine that I have seen on the market is with international grapes. And that is slightly fitting, I will say. And it's very interesting watching like the colonial project and how it unfolds agriculturally and how it unfolds specifically with wine. And like, you know, obviously there's such a romance to what you're doing, which is just like saying something's interesting. Saying it's romantic means it sucks. Like, I'm sure everyone would rather have a not romantic or not interesting life. And yet here we are. Seeing wine as an axis of resistance is, for me, truly astonishing. I wonder if this is a good opportunity to talk about the Grapes of Wrath cuvée and how I read something that you mentioned about how you don't like to use that as a sales pitch, like but the mysticism of that wine is pretty fucking wild. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I had to start saying something, and I think I should make a post that just clearly explains everything, because I've heard, you know, sort of people create.
I heard it's like parting like the Red Sea, right? Like the wall actually just fell down, and the grapes tumbled through. Is this correct?
What it is that it's a part of a vineyard of 90-year-old white grapes, mm-hmm. 90 plus. Now, when I started, it was around already 80 plus years with it, and I was just walking in the vineyard, getting to know the different parts, the different grapes. And there was part of the vineyard that was partially destroyed by the army to make a road for a settlement.
Okay.
And what they had done, they had crushed the vines with massive boulders up to 2 meters in height. Mm-hmm. And I was walking around, it was pruning season, so I just saw...
Why? Yes.
Because they can.
Okay. That's what I understood. No greater purpose other than just violence on the subject.
You know, let's say you wanted to build a house, mm-hmm. right? And then you're going to destroy it. And then you say, I'm going to detonate the whole house and mm-hmm. then just remove the rubble. But then your neighbor comes and knocks on your door and says, hey, man, do you think we can dismantle it, you know, slowly mm-hmm. and not put a bomb in the neighborhood?
Sure.
And you say, mm-hmm. let's do it, right? In this case, there is no dialogue because the other side that commits such acts does not consider us worthy of any dignity, right? So if you labor on your property for 90 years, it means absolutely fucking nothing to me. It's like I'm pushing away anything. I find it very difficult to penetrate into the psyche, you know, because... Mm-hmm. There is a limit to how much darkness a person can have, really, to pursue something with such diligence. One of the things that's been shocking me, you know, because Gaza obviously has been in the spotlight for the last few weeks, mm-hmm. is the periphery of Gaza grows about 75% of Israeli vegetables. I don't know the percentage on fruits, but 70%. And if you imagine like the hills of the West Bank is where all the rain sort of falls mm-hmm. and the aquifers sort of transfer the water towards Gaza, mm-hmm. right? And then these people suck up all the water, plant these orchards, produce what they produce, a wonderful wealth, mm-hmm. and then a few meters down the line, they're willing to kill 2 million people and deprive them of water. And in my mind, I can imagine maybe somebody doing that for once and feeling bad. Yeah. But to do this as a farmer day in and day out and feel pride and actual joy that you are, you know, depriving people of water every day, and that's some sort of anything meaningful for you as a human being, it is beyond my capacity to comprehend.
There's like a myth, I think, especially within natural wine, but in general, like the idea that taking care of the land and taking care of crops kind of infers like a moral characteristic on you. And it's actually, sometimes it's so fucking apparent that it actually doesn't. Like people can be good farmers and still be monsters. It's Yeah,
I don't understand it.
It's truly shocking, to be honest. And this is the part of this episode where I try to not cry. But the monstrosity is, it's not even shocking. It's just that Eichmann ass just following orders bullshit that is so evil. And so the Grapes of Wrath is a pretty good wine, though.
Yes. So about Grapes of Wrath, essentially, they've brought these boulders and mm-hmm. crushed the vines for up to 2 meters in height and mm-hmm. paved the road in between. And since then, they've cut up the plot several mm-hmm. more times. I think we're pretty much close to having our last vintage of Grapes of Wrath, basically, because there's been several layers of destruction mm-hmm. in the area. But these vines grew back from between the rocks. And when I saw them, I discussed them with the farmer. They had been basically some gray branches in February mm-hmm. over gray rock. And I asked if they still bear fruit. And he said, yes. And I said, please reserve the fruit of this area for me. And I'd like to try. And that year I was, we had like some frost or something. Mm-hmm. So actually the areas around didn't bear any fruit, but these vines from the rocks maybe maintained a little bit more heat mm-hmm. somehow. So yeah. I had nothing else my first year, mm-hmm. right? And I tried, and the quality of the wine worked. The story was an inspiration for me, mm-hmm. right? And I wanted to see if I can make a good wine with it. And it's one cuvée that I've been refining and changing and learn. I think by 2019, I understood the role of each grape in the blend. Mm-hmm. And then I started to, refine it more and more. So it's the one wine that I've produced every year in its own variation, depending on that vintage. But I did want to say something, since you started off with saying wine as an act of resistance. Mm-hmm. If one wanted to consider Filokalia an act of resistance, it would first be an act of resistance against the more predominant Palestinian mentality today, mm-hmm. And not anywhere else. Mm-hmm. The question Filokalia asks, amongst many questions, by the way, can one produce excellence even in this context?
Okay. Right?
Mm-hmm. So you have to understand that in this context, your family wants to look out for you. Your friends want you to be okay. And mm-hmm. people say, do enough to survive, to do something, to live, to be safe, to, mm-hmm. right? And you said, that's not enough. Can you still produce excellence, world-class quality maybe? Mm-hmm. Even in this context today, right? And it's easy to ask the question is one thing, but then do you... When you make something of quality, then you mm-hmm. start to be able to answer. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to push for quality and excellence in this context, regardless of the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And it starts off with being, primarily a Palestinian conversation.
Of course. I think that makes sense. Like also, that is the context of the wine. Like, I think a wine made specifically as in a global context would almost invariably be quite boring. Like your primary fight needs to be with the people you're closest to. Otherwise,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, if you're making a wine to say, fuck you to some winemaker in California, that's interesting, but there's no teeth to it. Sure. I think that makes complete sense, especially when you consider, like the history of wine in your region. And you mentioned, and again, in this great article, which I'll link, you mentioned how many restaurants in Bethlehem feature wines made explicitly in a colonial project on them. Like it makes clear sense why your struggle would be specifically with, I don't want to say your neighbors, but your neighbors, like the people, the closest, most intimate people.
For sure, because there aren't enough foundational denominators when it comes to looking at what we're doing. So if somebody says, I have a restaurant, mm-hmm. I'm trying to make a living, and making a living requires that maybe you make the maximum possible living per day, because mm-hmm. in this context, you don't know what you're going to be opening up for work tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Right. So you understand people's drive for maximizing profit. I'm not trying to say that people are not greedy. There are businessmen that are greedy everywhere.
I've heard of them.
But right. But there's also this this fear that also drives people. And they also have enough on their plate. And when you want to come and explain a wine like Filokalia, mm-hmm. not easy to get someone's attention. On one level. The other level is that they don't even know enough about wine. They're not invested in wine. Mm-hmm. For them, it's just, it could be a bottle of Coca-Cola, and, mm-hmm. and that's fine for the majority of them. So there are a lot of prerequisites to work with something maybe like Filokalia for them. But then I say what you're doing is, if you keep pursuing it that way, you will have anyway nothing to tell a tourist, because you will have zero identity, zero remnant of your own culture. And you have even no understanding of what's happening in the world. You travel around the world for a unique experience. If you had the same thing you had in your neighborhood, why go at all?
I'm just saying this as I'm seeing all of my colleagues at Lediv right now drinking the mm-hmm. same fucking wines they drink in Brooklyn. With the same annoying French people that come to visit New York. It's surely there's another wine festival you could go to. I want to refine or hop off something that you said, because I think it's something that I think what you said is your wine, good as it is, probably will not end the occupation. Strangely enough, people kind of complying, or people who are people without resistance, can preserve the occupation. Does that make sense? Like there is a sense that, like, by standing up again to other Palestinians, to struggling with other Palestinians, and demonstrating the greatness of the region, is the resistance is multipolar, I guess, is what I'm suggesting. Although, again, no one can fucking stop colonial violence, but that doesn't mean you have to act like you're happy about it. I'm really interested in the idea of, I don't want to say collaborationism, but like the local business actors who no longer care, you know, that's a hard road to hoe.
No, I think that the question of the occupation in general, for me, trying to work on something, let's say the wine industry, will have its particularities. It has its effect on every sector. But it's no different than any entrepreneur trying to establish something. Imagine today if you were starting off another wine project in Bordeaux. What would be your solution, right? Like, what's your answer to the
burn it down
to the competition? Maybe producing under occupation where there are so few producers. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have more space in the wine market, right? You'll have other challenges. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so sure how I would start off a wine project in France or Italy or mm-hmm. Spain or. I don't know. I think it comes with its own set of severe challenges. Maybe on some level, you have a good infrastructure, you have the country's reputation, you have the know-how. That's great. But I think that you will have challenges. I think that for the occupation specifically and in general, it is very, very difficult to pursue a creative act, because the creative act mm-hmm. means that the reality is somewhere, and you're trying to go somewhere else that you already see. Mm-hmm. So everything in your way is an obstacle.
Yes.
And the occupation is that one element that has its tentacle into so many of these obstacles at various degrees. You understand? So mm-hmm. if I would say culturally, wine is looked down upon. Okay, so if you don't sell in this area, you're okay. So mm-hmm. you have a problem if you sell locally, maybe, mm-hmm. right? But if you go down the street, you should be okay. Mm-hmm. So fine. But the occupation's tentacles reach into so many different aspects and at so many different facets, the psychological, the practical, etc. And then if you wanted to be a baker just to sell a few loaves a day and make a living, it's one thing to try to pursue a creative act. And the act, creative act is not easy anywhere, maybe, but I find that it doesn't leave room for the creative act. Right? There's room for having a gas station to supply people's cars with mm-hmm. petrol, but no one wants to pursue something that involves a creative act that also, you know, if you're in the wine business, you're basically saying, I'm in this for the long term. I plant, I work 4, 5, 10 years before I even have anything to show. In a survival-oriented context, you're on the wrong planet.
I mean, and I think that's one of the most interesting things about this project, which is it truly posits that there might be a future, which is, for an outsider, it is a breath of fresh air because, again, wine does think in the long term. Wine oftentimes thinks in the geologic fucking scale of things. So the idea of someone making, art wine, like interesting wine, like not just making wine, but making something that needs to actually be thought about and digested is a cry of there may be a future, which is, I don't know. I think that's pretty cool.
I don't know if there is a future or not, but I do know that there is now. And the question is, what am I doing now? Mm-hmm. Right. And I want to pursue something meaningful for myself. I don't know how long this thing will last, but you know, we'll keep trying. But I wanted to add a couple of things. One of them might help you remember Philokalia as a name the next time. So Philokalia means love of the beautiful, mm-hmm. The good, love of beauty. Here, beauty is considered in the sort of ancient Greek mm-hmm. Philosophical sense, which is the radiance of truth. And if there is a struggle in this project, it's also a conflict over the definition of beauty. Mm-hmm. And you tend to see so much missed opportunity to create beauty in this context.
Okay.
Right. That you start to say, okay, but does beauty still have a part? Right. And I don't really care if I did it in furniture or I did mm-hmm. it in architecture or, but in wine I found this little space where I can control the variables and really just depend on myself. But there is a conflict over the definition of beauty. Mm-hmm. And one of those conflicts is that, you know, you would see, let's say, a restaurant in Bethlehem, it would have a restaurant name like something Italian, like Cava or I don't know, some word. And I was sitting having lunch with my family because this wine project actually for the first time ever created these family lunches, right? And my mom is like so happy that it brings people together around the family because
that's really nice.
I come from a non-drinking family, and it was, I think, the only compliment I got from my family so far for the wine. But and I was just noting that, wow, it's amazing, these places are popping up in Bethlehem and things, and everyone has a foreign name. Mm-hmm. And then my mom looks at me and is like, you should speak. You have the most complicated out of all foreign names in the country. Right. And I'm like, Mom, Philokalia is 100% Palestinian. Like, what do you mean? Like, well, Philokalia is the name of a collection of writings by, you know, Eastern Christian mysticism is documented in a collection of writings called the Philokalia.
Oh, of course, the thing that everyone's aware of.
No, it's not, but it's a layer of history, just like of the Marsupians domesticated native grapes, mm-hmm. the Canaanites made wine and exported it. Mm-hmm. So in this project, I'm exploring 10,000 years of history, mm-hmm. and there is a lot of richness and diversity mm-hmm. in those layers. But, you know, for someone, it sounds like a foreign name today, mm-hmm. And for a local, it's a problem if they don't know their own heritage. I mean, finally, to know the Philokalia, even if I've gone to some Christian monks, and you know, we have some in like very old monasteries from like 438 AD. There's some monks in some monasteries, and they speak Greek, by the way. And I took them some bottles. I stayed there for a couple of nights one time.
Do they dig it?
My bottle. He's like, Philokalia. You know what it means, Philokalia. You know.
I mean, I feel like there's also nowhere in the, certainly in the Eastern Mediterranean, but in the Mediterranean in general, where you're not going to find at least a tiny Greek speaking community. Like,
yes, of course.
They like to get around a little bit. I want to talk about language, because you also mentioned how much Palestinian place names reference the vine and, you know, 10,000 years of winemaking history. I think something that hopefully our listeners will not have this notion, but something that many Americans aren't aware of is just how long wine's been a part of Palestine. Despite there being, you know, say quite a lot of Muslims. I wonder if that's a thing we could talk about, like the history of wine in the region, and I guess which is going to be the history of different ethnic groups within the region.
Well, it's hard to talk briefly about, 10,000 years of history, but
yeah.
To give it some context, you have to understand that as an industry, if it's been around for 10,000 years, mm-hmm. Palestinians have been asleep as far as winemaking for the last 1,500 of them. So it's not so bad. No?
They had a good run.
Yeah.
It taught the Egyptians the first vineyards in the Old Kingdom were, Canaanite vines. And I think they imported Canaanites to tend to them. They had walled clothes for the Old Kingdom pharaohs. So, you know, anything that they drank, I think, is pretty cool.
Yeah. So, but you have to understand that today wine has become so defined by the amazing amount of improvements mm-hmm. and attention that's been given to wine in Europe, the Romans, and then the church, mm-hmm. right? And then the British occupation of Bordeaux for 800 years. Mm-hmm. Etc. So there's been a tremendous amount of evolution in so many fields, right, over the last few decades or centuries. So in that time, obviously, we were not on the global map, and yes, because of Islam. Mm-hmm. Early Islam was different, because still the largest wine press in the Middle East is an Umayyad palace, which is one of the first dynasties of Muslims in Jericho.
Yes.
Right. And there was...
There's a lot of drinking also. There's a lot of a wink wink attitude at different points in history, I feel.
Yes, I mean, the worst was obviously with the Ottomans the last 400 or 500 years. This was a disaster. But until the Byzantine era, you know, a couple of years ago during COVID, the Israelis had excavated a Byzantine wine factory close to Tel Aviv that mm-hmm. was producing, they say, about 2 million liters a year with its own amphora factory.
Jesus Christ.
And then you had French historians like Grégoire Latour talking about Gaza wine merchants selling wine in Bordeaux in the 7th century. So the world was a very different place on some level. To also give you an idea about something in Islam that changed tremendously. In Islam, everything was a question, whether it's alcohol or music or poetry. So they talk about the pre-Islamic era, even Muslims, mm-hmm. when the Muslim Islamic institutions represent the history. Mm-hmm. They talk about paganism, pre-Islam. Mm-hmm. They talk about the days of ignorance, mm-hmm. right? The dark ages, intellectually, mm-hmm. the jahiliyyah, which means, mm-hmm. which comes from ignorance, mm-hmm. right? And yet at the same time in schools, we study about the best poetry still done in front of the Kaaba in mm-hmm. Saudi. Mm-hmm. Right, where they had poetry competitions, and the same rock that's the Kaaba, the sacred rock now, was the same rock that held the winning poem.
Okay, right? Yes.
Yeah, so they're called the hanging poems, because the winning poem would be hung on that rock, and it was mm-hmm. a pagan temple. But essentially, everything was a question, and everything was a subject for even argument and discussion and writing back and forth. So a Muslim scholar of, let's say, greater Syria would write something that says music should be banned. You know, music is haram, for example. You would have a Moroccan sheikh come up and write an article back or write something to say that, no, according to the religion, what you're saying is unfounded because there is this that supports this aspect of music. So there was always an exchange of ideas and a heated argument or discussion about any issue, right? But with the advent of Wahhabism from Saudi Arabia, they didn't come into the issue saying music is haram or alcohol is haram. What they basically said is the discussion is haram. You can no longer have a discussion. So you can see how a society was very active in so many fields, and you have examples in Andalusia and others, and the Abbasids in Iraq, you know, Persians during the Islamic era, even the Mughals. So there was always this creative collaboration, let's learn from others, an exchange of cultures. But with Wahhabism, what you end up with is, let's break the fundamental mechanism, which says, it doesn't matter what the subject is, the discussion about it is haram. The mechanism of discussion is haram. And that basically means intellectually you're finished.
I have been waiting for 5 years of this podcast to talk about Wahhabism, and this is so fucking exciting. Thank you. The amount of conversations we've had to cut from this podcast about Islamic theology when I've had, like, you know, too much wine. So exciting. I do wonder. I think that discussion is so germane because, you know, in the West, oftentimes it is presented as, oh, Islam is anti-wine. Islam is also anti-fun, and this idea of fundamentalism, which is not really borne out by the history, and which does make places like, say, Lebanon, like Palestine, like Syria, like fucking Turkey, even where there's so much wine produced historically, it makes it just seem like it kind of covers it up. It's like you know, an iron curtain of wine. The idea there couldn't have been anything ever made there in the last 1,000 years, which is, you know,
let me tell you just one example that you have to see the repercussions of it until our day. Right. So during the Abbasid dynasty, there was one of the people you would consider a professor of aesthetics. His name was Ziryab. And Ziryab excelled beyond his own teachers, and which was a faux pas, right? In, you know, more like classical societies, like you would train under a master.
Currently here as well. You have to wait till they die.
Yeah, but probably in this area it's a little bit worse. So he left Iraq anyway, and he went to Andalusia, which was, you know, a Muslim caliphate as well.
Friend of the pod.
Right. And then when he arrived, he saw how people were eating there. And it's a little bit how people in our part of the world eat today, which is one large table with everything on it, all the foods, the fruits, the desserts, whatever, right? All at one time on the table. And they were drinking wine out of tin cups. And this man lost his mind when he saw that scene. He's like, this is absolutely not how you should eat. A meal is served in courses. You would start off with a soup or a salad, and then you go on to the main course, and then your dessert. And specifically for this wine, you people need to understand, you know, the standard wine glass that we know today, which is a clear glass with a neck. This is called a Damascene glass, referring to Damascus. Right? And he said, wine should be drunk out of clear glass to appreciate its color, right? It should be on a stem because it's a noble beverage, and that when you hold it, your hand should not affect the temperature of the glass, right? He also taught the Europeans that area how to dress with the seasons and the fabrics and things like this. Because you have to understand, the reference until almost that time was essentially Greek, right? Greek, some Roman, but a lot of Greek, right? And the musical instruments, let's say like the violin, right, were associated with have four strings, and they were associated with the four elements and the four bodily humors. And if you were feeling sick in a certain way, they would prescribe a melody on a certain string. There was this philosophy of, you know, harmony and the movement of the planets. There's this whole system of thought, right? And Ziryab was one of the first people after centuries to break that formula by saying there has to be a fifth string to the instrument, which was the lute, right? They all had four strings.
And he said, fifth element.
Yes, and he said for the soul, right? And then people expanded it to a six strings, and then the guitar became the six strings, which had a large, you know, broader musical range. But these were philosophical discussions, right? And the Europeans adopted a culture from Spain towards France and kept on refining it. That started here, right? And now we've forgotten where we've come from. Right? So that glass you drink, yes, but that glass you drink of wine today, be thankful to a Muslim.
Every day.
No, but I mean, you understand that there is somebody in Islam at that time saying, wine is haram. No one should drink wine. Wine should be banned. And there is someone taking wine to heights unimagined at that time, at the same time.
I literally can't even stress this enough how much this is the conversation I always want to be having. So it's one of those things that, like, when you talk about wine from this region, and you just, like, you need to, like, make, like, this is wine's home. It does not fucking matter, like, the religious groups, like the push and pull, the interplay. This is where wine's from, and this is where wine's going to continue to be fucking from. And I find it actually tremendously inspiring in a way. But also
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, of course.
Even in my experience today with Filokalia, and I say it with no shame whatsoever, the people who supported my project the most actively and morally have been a majority of nothing but Muslims. And none of them drink.
That's awesome.
I've had one guy from a refugee camp who spent 6 months with me on the road between Bethlehem and Hebron looking for old vines to test and experiment with. Right? It was a difficult period also for me. There was a lady treating me like a masseuse, that's a therapist. She treated me for a long time as I'm struggling to, you know, creating something for myself with all these burdens that were sometimes psychological, but they affect you physically. And she said, no, what you're pursuing is nice. Let me help you, you know, understand. The person who first told me to stop depending on raising funds, making a corporation, just depending more on myself, was also a Muslim. The guy who inspired this project was also, he's no longer a Muslim, but he comes from a Muslim background. And he taught me about the history. This is not about, Islam is not a problem. Islam is just an option for any person to do anything and become more aware of things, right? You can choose whatever tool you want at your disposal, right? But the problem is when it's politicized, when it becomes about me versus you, right? There isn't enough space for people. When it becomes a way to fuel and disguise other issues, other problems in a society.
Yes, sir.
Right? We're not discussing Islam. How many people do you see discussing any religion that actually have knowledge of their religion or even opened up the text and read for themselves? We can't have serious discussions with people who don't know anything. It's just, you know, like parrots repeating words they've heard left and right, but maybe I've memorized 10 ideas, maybe you've memorized 20, so you sound smarter, but we're both idiots.
I agree. I think I want to swing a little bit less theoretical, because we're running out of time here. But not too, well, actually, something I want to kind of talk about.
Take your time as far as I'm concerned.
I'm good to go. The concept of mysticism in wine, reading your writings, speaking to you, there's an idea, at least among wine people in the United States, of demystifying wine, of breaking it down and creating something that can be easily understood. And then when you speak with winemakers, and yourself included, you see the almost the exact opposite, which is this is like so kaleidoscopically confusing that, you know, you're mentioning like the soil changes by each foot, and you know there's so many factors at play that the only real option is to embrace the mysticism of this. Like this is truly you know, wine contains so many more multitudes than you can actually just write on a tech sheet. And I wonder, like, if you feel the ability to explain what you do, or if it's always just kind of like a throwing up in the hands, like, I don't know, the fucking grapes make this, I'm just here. Like how do you handle that tension?
Well, the result is now I'm bold and the rest of the hairs are gray because okay. of that tension of anticipation, what's going to happen in this tank a few months later. Mm-hmm. I mean, you ask a question that can go in so many different directions, and I don't want either one direction to attempt to represent the whole experience.
Of course.
I'll give you some extremes. I'd spend time with some of the best winemakers in, say, France, some mm-hmm. in Italy, the ones that I found were relevant to my work. Mm-hmm. So in Bordeaux, it was about learning about blending. Mm-hmm. In Burgundy, it was understanding terroir. Mm-hmm. And the Roussillon, mm-hmm. Languedoc-Roussillon, it's a little bit about a similar terroir to here. Mm-hmm. Friuli for orange wine, etc. Mm-hmm. And I spent time with a French winemaker from the Languedoc named Pascal Frisson, who's, mm-hmm. You know, he sort of adopted me for a while and really got me into the spirit of winemaking. And until then, I had been trying to learn about wine technically and what to do mm-hmm. For, you know, what is the answer for each step of this process? Mm-hmm. During my second vintage, 2016, I was going through a very difficult personal time, and it was a very sad harvest. Mm-hmm. Right? But I pushed along and I made the work technically as best as I could, and everything was fine and sales were good. And I had sent Pascal a bottle and I didn't hear back from him for maybe 2 years, 3 years. And then I had a chance to go visit Pascal. Mm-hmm. Right. I said, Pascal, I didn't hear back from you about that bottle I sent you a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And he was in his kitchen cutting up some, I think, Pyrenees ham or something. Mm-hmm. And he's like, so what did you think of that wine? And he didn't tell me that he was cutting the stuff. And he said, well, bon, je l'ai trouvé triste. Yeah. I found the wine to be sad. Right. And that hit me like a rock, right, on the chest. Because I realized that moment that all this talk that, you know, they would, France, winemaking in France is a very refined spiritual act, because there is really this, you work on yourself. It's a polishing of the self to be able to make finer and finer wines. And you read it and it sounds good, etc. But he spotted it in the wine, right? And from that moment on, I realized more consciously that I should really work on myself as a person.
I've tasted wines like that. Some of my friends who are winemakers, and I'm thinking of one particular who, during a very bad breakup, all of his ferments were just, they were there, but they were, the wine, and I wish I kept bottles of it, because the wines, they tasted sad. They tasted like, not like his wines, and obviously you can say, oh well, maybe he was doing less work because he was working on something else, and there's always a real explanation, there's a realistic explanation.
Sure.
And then you just keep on expending the brain power for, oh, this is why, this must be why, and then it's almost much easier and more logical at point to be like, I guess it's fucking magic, I don't care, because why not?
Sure. But that being said, it's one of the oldest crafts in the world, mm-hmm. right? And there's still so many things to discover. right? About winemaking and about wine and about wine enjoyment and about also how it can be produced. You know, wine has been evolving for 10,000 years. It hasn't been produced in the same way for 10,000 years. They've been cutting diamonds the same way for 1,000 years, but you know, but it's no, the craft has evolved. Which and also, if you ferment any other fruit, in most cases, if you ferment a banana, you get banana flavors. You do an apple, you get apple flavors. And grape is that one thing where you get so much more out of grape, right? And I don't know what that is. It's maybe nature's choice, right?
It's this weird obsession we've all been doing for it. I'm giving a talk at the New School about it's called Wine and Everything, which I keep on quoting things that we're saying right now for this, but like there is something truly like ineffable about the project of making wine, which is almost embarrassing to admit. But yeah, I don't know. The grapes contain everything. I'm not a scientist. I don't care. That's what we all see. That's what we all know. And you can expend a lot of brain power explaining it away, or just say, like, it's there.
It has that. But also, I will tell you from now, like being attentive to several micro plots, and we produce a very small volume, and trying to learn more and more. People will tell you, like, you know, I have this magical terroir, as if, you know, nobody has such thing like that in the world. I don't buy it. I think every step of the process, how you work the land and how you work in the cellar, you know, every step of the process has its contribution and has its role, right? But it's a complex layer of things, layering of things that make wine, but it's, I don't know if we have to demystify wine. I think we have to almost accept that it's one of those great things that mankind has not really figured out completely, and we still enjoy. Yeah. There could be mystery in the product, but I shouldn't feel afraid of the mystery. But the only other issue that a consumer suffers from is that there's so much between them and the wine that they don't get to look at the wine and consciously experience the wine and independently explore the wine without somebody shoving something in their face or in their mind, right? Oh, you should try this wine. This is a great wine. Why do you have to decide for me it's a great wine, right? Why do you even have to tell me what your version of greatness is? Maybe I would say it is a very elegant wine. I'm amazed that it's elegance. You're amazed that it's greatness. But, you know, people should just let the wine speak a little bit for itself if it has anything to say. And I think that it's good we still have wine, and it is mysterious for people, because people are put at a choice whether, do you want to have a deeper experience in things, or do you just want to deal with the known? So accept the mystery a little bit. It's fine. I know tremendous amounts of wines in the world are done, you know, wine by formula and mass market wines. I understand this. And that's maybe not where you look for experience, but also you cannot say if you go in the middle of Times Square that you have an experience of life in the US.
Of course.
Right? It is the most visited, maybe, etc. So allow the wine to speak to you. Allow yourself to have your own individual pleasure with it. Allow it to be woven into your life the way that fits you. Try to sometimes enjoy a wine with a little bit of quietness, you know, not maybe two people on the table, maybe not 10, right? But try to find some wines, I think, will offer a growth experience after which you will not be the same as a person, but it's a good way to also be more conscious overall in your experience. And you can't become more conscious if you say, no, first of all, you have to clarify it for me, and it has to be easier, and I have to understand it. Then you're sitting in your comfort zone. There's nothing happening. Right? Why go to a great college? Why attempt a great artwork? Why attempt to build something that no one has done before? Because you want to demystify, but it's already a mystery. You're celebrating mystery every day, because if you told someone, I'm going to the moon 100 years ago, they would say, this person is crazy, right? It's a mystery for them, this rocket going into space, no? But they're happy about it. Okay, so why should wine be simplified, but this is another type of journey. Just enjoy that it can be mysterious and at the same time not intimidating, because I wouldn't want to see a rocket leaving from my backyard going, you know, into outer space. It's not something I would want to see.
No, certainly not. I mean, there's a real terror in mysticism. I do think this is as good a spot as any to pull the plug on this, which is, I love this phrase, it's been a whirlwind interview, which I don't get to do very often. What is the best way for people to find your wines and experience a little bit of the mystery for themselves?
We've been fortunate to work with Terra Santa Trading with Jason for the last couple of years in the U.S. Specifically. And so, you know, we're not able to bring into the U.S. everything that we've been working on.
I imagine not.
At the moment, because we also have a lot of smaller cuvées that are experimental and guiding the future. But Terra Santa Trading
in Europe?
Not for the moment.
Okay.
Not for the moment. So either directly from us or from Terra Santa Trading in the U.S. And I think we're having some traction. I mean, if you gave us a call for an interview, we must have caught your attention a little bit, which is nice.
The wines are, I've said this, I think, three times in the podcast now, staggeringly good. Speaking to you, the wines even become more contextualized. Like, they are contemplative, contradictory, and they are wound up into, I think, the wines are very much a product of many things. Like, you drink the wine, you say, I feel like there is a lot going on under the surface. And then meeting you, it's like, oh, yes. Which is always a fun thing. You know, sometimes you get the opposite. You get a really expressive wine with a winemaker who says nothing. And then you're like, oh, they must be hiding it. I fully endorse Terra Sancta. We should, I'll get your website. I'll put it in the description notes. And I've had friends actually, there's a couple online sellers in the U.S. that have access to the wines. I have a couple friends who bought them off auction sites, and I would say, fucking do it, because they are wonderful.
I have no idea what's happening in your part of the world with the wines. I think we're too busy with the craftsman's perspective, so we have to give some confidence that, you know, Jason and the people who have adopted the wine know what they're doing. We're happy to learn.
I believe.
With that being said, I'm sure we haven't started producing wines at the quality that we will be releasing soon. I think that it's been a good almost 10-year phase of exploration, and people's interest have made it sustainable. But I think there's so much to explore. I feel like we've popped open a Pandora's box of possibilities as far as winemaking and aging, because we've discovered, you know, we've been producing our own amphoras, but we've discovered that they're more interesting for aging than they are for fermentation.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense. That's what they were used for so long, like aging and transport.
Correct. But it's one thing to read about it, right? And then when you see the samples, so in the first 2 months, you've had this integration of aromas. Typically in a wine, more complex or less, you'd have a linear sequence of expressions. Mm-hmm. This brings it all together. The integration is kind of like perfume. It's mind-blowing. And then the tannins develop this width and depth that's just, you know, I don't know, it goes somewhere else. But to make a long story short, I look forward to even like pursuing this discussion with more and more interesting wines as we evolve. I think we're just sort of beginning here.
I would say I'm tremendously excited to taste more of your wines in the future. And this is maybe a little bit corny, but please stay safe out there.
We'll do our best. Thank you very much. You as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for listening. I will say drink Palestinian wine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.